somebody in one of the groups, and there was what made the victory a bit easier to achieve.
The green jersey classification is now on 7 points. The fight is really on between Mads Pedersen and Jasper Philipsen now.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Time is 7:07. The location is Rouen, where, of course, stage 17 of the Tour de France has finished today. I'm not at the finish line. I've passed all the team buses, walked about a kilometre beyond the team buses up a hill, getting some strange looks from people in teams who wondered where I was going. And I have come to a pretty anonymous-looking spot, a place called Campus La Brunerie, and it is a sort of campus, not exactly a university campus, but more a sports campus. There's an athletics track that I can see, various buildings, office buildings. We'll talk about them in a minute. Just over the other side of the road is a sort of centre commercial that anyone who's travelled in France will be familiar with. Shops like Conforama, there's a McDonald's there. The sort of place that if you're very lucky on the Tour de France, you'll end up dining in the evening. Beyond the centre commercial, we've got green hills, the sort of foothills of the Alps, and if I turn slightly, the much more spectacular rockier outcrops of the Chartreuse Massif, which is a famous location in the history of, well, the Tour de France, and also races like the, well, particularly the Dauphiné. Why am I here? Well, I'm about to explain. And I am indebted for much of what you're about to hear to my colleague Julien Chesnay, who wrote a very interesting story in L'Équipe today about the first contacts between Decathlon and Paul Sexas and the Sexas family. Of course, today's day started in Chambéry. That is really the home city of that team. Decathlon has always been, since the time, the era when it was Casino and Vincent Lavenue was in charge. So how did it all come about? Well, in July 2021, Paul Sexas, at 14 years of age, became French national champion on the road for the first time. And that very day, two sort of recruiters, or two gentlemen involved with the Groupama FDJ's junior team, approached Paul Sexas about the possibility of him joining their organisation and their sort of network of teams. Very soon thereafter, the other big French team, Decathlon, and their junior organisation, they also made a pitch via Alex Pacour, who we heard from a few episodes ago. He's still Paul Sexas' coach. And another Alex, Alexandre Chenives. They invited Sexas, Paul, and his parents to come and see them at their HQ, which was, well, it was right here, where I'm standing, in Voiron, just about a kilometre from the finish line today, on this Campus La Brunerie, where Decathlon and their junior team, they had some offices. And the meeting occurred in August 2021, and that was where the pitch was made to the Sexas family, and they ultimately agreed. They ultimately said yes to Decathlon, no to Groupama FDJ, and the rest is history. This has become a hot topic in professional cycling. Tadej Pogacar sort of opening the floodgates of young talent. We've seen in the last few years that World Tour teams are recruiting riders younger and younger. Agents are recruiting riders younger and younger. And certainly what's happened at the Tour de France this year with Sexas has sort of given us pause for reflection on this topic. And it's given a lot of people in the sport pause for reflection. When to really put one's foot on the accelerator as far as young talent is concerned, and when the brakes need to be pumped. And these are themes that have been very important in the story of Paul Sexas, as we're going to find out. Ça revient, it's coming home. How France will win the Tour again is a Kilometre Zero series written and produced by me, Daniel Freiber. Ad-free versions of these episodes will be available exclusively for friends of the Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up as a friend of the podcast, and please remember that by doing so, you are enabling us to cover the Grand Tours on the ground and produce these special series and episodes. The only individual time trial of the 2026 Tour de France takes place in Évian-les-Bains, a town world famous for its mineral water and latterly as the venue for the G8 and G7 summits. The marketeers claim the water is naturally filtered through glacial rock layers over at least 15 years before gushing from springs above the town. which, if true, means that water in your fancy plastic bottle may have fallen on the Alps as rain not long after, or even around the time Paul Seixas was born, an hour or so away in Lyon. Talking of natural phenomena and their source, Stage 16 is also a family affair for Paul Seixas. The paternal grandparents who starred in Decathlon's Tour de France announcement video, 85-year-old José Manuel and 81-year-old Suzanne Seixas, spend their afternoon inside the Decathlon inner sanctum, mostly waiting at the team bus for Paul to return after his latest exertions. When he does, it's around an hour after Remco Evenepoel has been confirmed as the stage winner, and Seixas as the fourth fastest over the 26.1-kilometre course. On a day when anti-doping was high on the news agenda, Seixas was summoned for his second test in the space of 24 hours after crossing the line. Hence the delay in getting back to the bus. His grandmother chastises him loudly for not immediately giving her a hug. But as we've heard already in this series with Seixas, when it comes to cycling and especially recovery, everything has a reason, an order. Granny and Grandad will get their embrace, just as we'll get our interviews, but only after a further 20 minutes warm down. Well, after your crash in the Dauphiné, can you just talk about your relationship with sort of risk in this tour? Obviously, the descent today was fast, but how are you trying to sort of manage risks?
There's days like this, you have to put your brain behind. And of course, we crash sometimes, but we keep going, and cycling in downhills, it's part of the risk, and there's not always no 0% chance of risk on crashing on downhills. It's sometimes scary, but you have to do it, and you have to trust also the tires you have, the team behind you doing the best work they can to put you in safety on your bike. So I trust them 100%. Today's was a good day to test it. On the down here, sometimes I was really on the limit, and after that I just take a bit less risk. But yeah, I am on my bike, I'm safe, and there's 5 days to go, so don't take too much risk, but also don't take zero risk. That's, you have to find the right balance, and today I found it.
Merci à tous.
At times when he leaned into the apex of some of the bends on the Côte de l'Orange that afternoon, Seixas's bike appeared more horizontal than vertical. We saw the fans watching on their phones swoon and wince, then audibly exhale when another corner was safely negotiated. In the second half of the descent, Seixas seemed to become more measured, more conservative with his lines, as though he too had finally realised what was at stake. We'd seen something similar in a different context in the Tour of the Basque Country in April. Then, on the final day, in a downpour with the race all but won, he impulsively, needlessly and heedlessly attacked mid-stage, only to either see sense or be called to order by his director sportifs. I tell myself, watching him swoop down towards Lac Léman, that many of those who knew the young, in fact even younger Seixas, would be smiling if their hearts weren't in their mouths. Marc? Just a few hours before his TT, I speak to Marc Pacheco, who first encountered Seixas as an 8-going-on-9-year-old at the Lyon Sprint Evolution Club, wobbling around the middle of the Parc de la Tête d'Or velodrome with other beginners on Wednesday afternoons. Pacheco tells me Seixas barely knew his left brake lever from his right, but there was no mistaking his potential. A Ferrari engine in a Twingo chassis, he tells me, using a metaphor I've heard in other interviews.
En France, là, j'ai dit, il avait un moteur de Ferrari dans une carrosserie de Twingo.
Three lungs was another epithet the Lyon Sprint Evolution coaches coined after seeing Seixas fly, literally fly, up the Côte de Néron climb in the north of Lyon, Pacheco says. He had seen and coached plenty of young riders. Since last racing himself in 1986, Pacheco says that at last count, riders he's coached have won 163 French national titles. Many of them have been blessed with strong hearts and lungs, but what also made Seixas different were his application and perfectionism. One of Pacheco's fondest memories is not of a race success won by minutes, but the day when, after a sloppy standing start and lap of the Tête d'Or track, he sheepishly asked Pacheco whether he could do the drill again, or, in fact, until he got it right. If Seixas was a good student and attentive listener, it was perhaps also because his mother, Emmanuel, was a teacher herself, and his father, also called Emmanuel, a demanding, analytical, but also supportive guide, says Pacheco. Marc would often visit their home in the southern suburbs of Lyon and discuss their son's progress over a glass of wine or beer. Meanwhile, Paul would be riding up and down the driveway, zigzagging between skittles or practicing one-handed turns. Michael Buffaz hadn't been a coach as long as Pacheco, but he was a pro on the road for a decade, spending his last 6 years with Cofidis. He'd ridden the Tour in 2011. He knew what it took to survive the world's hardest race. And somehow, instinctively, when he also saw Seixas ride a bike for the first time at one of those Wednesday afternoon sessions at Lyon Sprint Evolution, he knew that Seixas would one day win the Tour.
Ah oui, 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 je... il est arrivé au club et il avait le même âge que mon fils, un an d'écart. Ouais.
Buffaz's own son was the same age as Seixas and in the same coaching sessions. But Michael says that Seixas defied all age categories, every precedent from all the alumni the coaches had seen before. Again, acting or thinking on instinct, Buffaz knew or understood that his job would mainly be to keep Seixas in check.
On n'apprend pas à gérer ce genre de, d'anomalie, donc... moi, mon rôle, je me suis dit, j'ai quatre trucs à faire. C'est lui demander ce qu'il a envie de faire.
Ouais.
Et l'empêcher de faire tout ce qu'il a
fait. Hence, he deliberately placed Paul in a group of weaker riders, forcing him to overcome his natural introversion and become a leader and guide for his slower peers. Michael capped Paul's training sessions at 12 or 15 kilometers a week, when he says three lungs could easily and very happily have done 60. He also banned him from some Wednesday sessions and took him to a climbing gym on Tuesdays and Thursdays instead to improve his coordination and core strength. Buffaz says that Seixas would sometimes sulk, but a bigger battle had to be fought and won with Seixas's parents, who didn't initially understand why Paul was being held back. Buffaz thinks that on reflection, he turned it into the worst period of Seixas's young life. He was constantly being shackled and told no. Michael says that he taught Seixas about boredom, but at least he wasn't killing the kid's appetite by letting him ride and train himself into exhaustion and maybe burnout. His parents are very, very intelligent people, Michael tells me, and eventually they saw there was method to Buffaz's madness. When Paul was 14 and his mother got a new job close to where they now live in Anse, the Seixases told Buffaz they would still commute to Paul's sessions in Lyon, but Buffaz persuaded them otherwise. All those hours in the car would feel like going to a job. Yes, there were times when it could feel as though he was ruining Paul's fun, but it was all a question of moderation, of knowing how and when to feed his hunger. Paul's frustration with Buffaz could turn to delight when Buffaz announced they were going to race up a climb, the former Cofidis pro versus the 40-kilo waif. Paul had long since got sick of riding with and dropping his father. Throughout those five formative, in fact, maybe pivotal years, Buffaz says that he was haunted by one fear.
Ça a été un jeu comme ça pendant 4-5 ans où... moi, ma plus grande peur, c'était de le gaver du vélo et qu'il me dise j'arrête le vélo.
Seixas being exposed to so much cycling that he'd get to age 16 or 17 and decide he'd had enough, take up football or something else, lose the love. Instead, Michael says he has no concerns now about Seixas being so meticulous, so dialed in at age 19 that he has no more margins to exploit. Seixas is almost pathologically obsessed with his quest, not for excellence, but perfection, Buffaz says. Most importantly, that quest still feels more like a game than an obligation.
Il a appris beaucoup de choses, il a soif d'apprendre, mais ses qualités font que il sera jamais rassasié. Il sera jamais rassasié tant parce que la perfection, ça n'existe pas chez nous. J'ai essayé de le rappeler plusieurs fois après. Il m'a plus jamais adressé la parole.
Paul Seixas is the youngest rider to compete in the Tour de France for 89 years, and there are also only five teenagers in men's World Tour teams this year. Nonetheless, there is no doubt that the last few years have seen an accelerating fetishization of youth in professional cycling. This is in part due to landmark successes like the two consecutive Tour de France victories by Egan Bernal and Tadej Pogacar, but also an evidence and science-based realization that 18 and 19-year-olds should always have been able to compete in pro cycling, at least from a physiological point of view. As Fred Grapp of Groupama FDJ told us earlier in the series, What's changed mainly is that teenagers now have access to most of the same information as established pros. As a result, Grapp told us, cycling has become a normal sport, meaning you don't have to be 23 or 24 to survive and thrive in the top tier.
Mais dans les autres sports, ça n'a jamais été ça. Donc le cyclisme est devenu un sport normal. C'est normal que les jeunes marchent plus tôt. C'est avant que c'était pas normal.
The scramble for younger and younger talents that's ensued can be seen in the numbers, like the average age of World Tour rookies falling by over a year in the last decade. But it's also evident in conversations with riders, team managers and agents, many of whom wonder how far the trend will go and who will pay the price. Picnic Post NL have over the years been one of the World Tour teams with the best records of nurturing young riders. And yet some of their struggles in recent months can also be explained by every outfit now gambling heavily and very expensively on youth, at ages and levels well beneath their under 23 or development programs.
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
One of Picnic's coaches, Matt Winston, was once British national junior team coach. In Chambéry on Wednesday, we discussed the phenomenon, how and when it originated, the collateral damage, and maybe also what the Sexas experience can teach us. So,
even under 18, just to explain the change that you've seen.
Yeah, I think kind of, you're right, since probably COVID and there was a group of riders there through COVID that were kind of 16, 17, 18 that lost, I guess, really out on their development years. And then after that, they kind of, a lot of them came flying into the sport, which was kind of a little bit of an unknown and set the bar pretty high for those young guys coming through. And I think, yeah, we're seeing now more and more just younger talent coming into the World Tour at the age of 18. I think for some guys it really fits and really suits, but I think it's not a one model fits all. When I look to it, I think some riders need more time in development teams. It's good now that there's a lot of World Tour development teams where they feel in the process, and there they shouldn't rush the process, because at that age some riders will have developed more than others.
And tell me broadly, I mean, your team, you obviously know more about your team than others, but broadly, how early are World Tour teams getting involved now? Are we sort of 15, 16-year-olds?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, and it's not something that we're necessarily doing, but I hear the rumours that, you know, riders as young as 14, 15 are being kind of touted a little bit, talked to by World Tour teams. I guess they're also, I heard the other day there's 14-year-olds now with agents, which for me is crazy. And, you know, some of our older guys in the team still don't have an agent now, but it just goes to show that the model of where people are looking, and parents, young riders, young clubs are thinking, wow, by the time you get to 16, you've almost not made it if you're not in a World Tour team. And for me, that's really, it's not the case. And yeah, I had a meeting the other week with a young rider whose dad just said, can you give us some advice? And I said to him, the first thing you have to do, you're 14, just enjoy it. Just go and enjoy it. Race your bike. Your results will start to come through as a junior. And yeah, of course, also what teams are looking at is not only the talent but they're looking at the headroom as well. If you sign a 16-year-old that's been training like a pro for 5 years, then how much headroom have they got? How much development can they still do? And it's all about gauging that as well. So you can also tell that, you know, seems like the common way now to recruit is a two-tiered approach where you look at the power numbers, but you're also looking at the human and the personal side. And when you look at someone's training peaks, for example, where a lot of the data for a lot of riders is stored, you can see the volume that they've done. So you can already start to look at, okay, what the power numbers are like and where that level goes to. Do I think 14-year-olds should be on power meters? Personally, no. I think they should just be learning the feel of being a bike rider, learning how hard it is to go deep and not really necessarily looking to those numbers. But, you know, when there's a lot of teams asking for that already at 16, then I can see why people do it.
cycling is a sport where performance is so, well, it's dictated by physiology so much. I mean, you're probably familiar with, in the old East Germany, they used to have ways, and I don't know too much about exactly which ways they employed, to gauge, even like a 9-year-old's, to gauge, you talk about headroom, how much physiological headroom, estimates of how tall they were going to be. In NBA basketball, they do similar things. I think in Premier League football, they do similar things. Have you heard of anything like that being employed in cycling?
Not necessarily like any techniques, but I do think the whole landscape of professionals is going to change. I've said it before. I think I've said it on the podcast before. I think we're going to see a shift come down, almost like an average age of like 6 years. Where, you know, we've got guys like John Degenkolb in the bus still today, who still feels like a junior when he comes to Tour de France. But then, you know, you've got the guys that are winning a lot these days, and they're already talking about retirement, and they're still kind of in their late 20s. And I think that will start to become more and more the norm, whereas a pro didn't become really a pro till they were 24, 25. Their glory days were 28, 29, 30, maybe even 32. And then they continued for a few years after that. Whereas now I think what we're seeing is they're almost, you turn professional at 19, 20, your glory years are 22 to 25, and then you have those twilight years where you're kind of racing. I mean, yeah, obviously the guys that are winning the biggest races, they're not in twilight years and they're that age, but you see, I think you know what I mean. And then how long are they going to continue in the 30s? I think, and also with the salaries now that are going in cycling, they almost don't need to continue into the 30s because they're making a lifestyle where they can live off. So I do think that's also going to change a little bit the landscape of cycling in the coming 10 years.
Working with young riders over the years, Matt, how has it changed or shaped your view of just nature versus nurture in terms of, well, the influence that trainers, parents and so on and so forth have? I mean, there is a school of thought that, okay, someone like Tiger Woods had a very pushy parent, but he sort of survived it. And there are people who say, well, look at that. That's evidence that someone like him, because of his genetic makeup or whatever, would have made it anyway. But what do you think about that? How much parents and coaches have a role?
Oh, for sure they have a massive role. But that's not changed for me. I think kind of, you know, when I look back to when I was the talent team coach and also the junior national coach, the influence of the parents has always been on the high level, and the parents are doing their best. Mm-hmm. And of course you get some where maybe they're a bit more pushy than others, and some will give kind of they send the child and say, okay, it's you decide. I don't know anything about cycling. And some people come in with a bit of knowledge and they also want to really have that input. But across the sport, to make the step as a junior, you need a parent that's going to drive you to races. They're going to invest the money in the equipment, which is also crazy high prices. And of course some local bike shops, local teams help out a little bit, which is really nice, but it's still a massive investment. So you need the parents, but you need them also on board in, like you say, in the right way. And I think the trainers are also always had a little bit of an influence because you had your club coaches. Yeah. And they did a really good job. What's changed is the knowledge. Yeah. So now, like, you know, when I look back at what I was, when I was coaching the youth team, we do like roller 10-mile time trials, no power meter, just as fast as you can on rollers. You'd go out on the road, you'd do kind of 6 sprints for the lamppost, you'd do kind of Russian steps, you'd do kind of progressive efforts, but it was all on feel. It was like, maybe, and then when they got to a point where they could feel, then you'd change the heart rate, go to heart rate zones. And even when, you know, we won world titles in the junior team pursuit, and that was only, what, in 2012, 2013, we weren't using power meters. We were just doing it all on feel and all on kind of trackside work and coaching. Whereas now I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that's all power based and kind of they're really looking at the detail. But that's also the reason why they're going 15 seconds faster than when I was coaching them. So
it feels unrealistic to put the genie back in the bottle and tell a 15-year-old they can't have a power meter.
It does. And I think that's the hardest part, because is the love of sport for some people just going to disappear? And I think that's, you know, because what you see now, and again, like when I talk about my experience from when I was kind of working in that environment, I was organising youth races, and I would get 60, just under 16 boys come into a Saturday criterium, and then there'd be like 50 in the under 14s, so on. Now there's like 20, 25 under 16. So because they're going to have the fun and everyone putting a gazebo up, you're having a picnic at the finish, everyone's playing football together on the field, I think that's starting to die off now, and it's all about going to the race, going full gas, trying to show who you are and then going home. And so it's that balance, isn't it? For sure the sport's better, it's more professional, But are the young guys enjoying it as much as they once did? You know, the ones that are winning, of course they are. But then I guess the guys that are getting a kick in every week, is how much fun is that? And, you know, I don't know the answer, really.
Well, just last thing then. What's the most common thing, without naming names, obviously, but what's the most common thing that you've seen ruin talent? What's the, if you had to sort of write a formula for ruining young talent, what's the thing that you've seen that most consistently will do it?
I think doing too much too young when the enjoyment's gone. You know, so like if the enjoyment started to dwindle a little bit, just stop. Just stop and go and play a bit of cricket, play a bit of football with your friends for a few weeks and then come back. You know, like you're not going to lose that much. It's the summer holidays now back in the UK, and maybe we're now, what, in middle of July. So if you've got a junior rider that's been racing since March and he's now starting to think, oh, still got two more, go and take 2 weeks off, go and play out, and you know, have some fun, do another sport, enjoy yourself, and go on the local club run, you know, go and speak with some guys that also enjoy bike racing and just find that fun again, and then you can build again, you know. And I think that's what's where I see the most common cause of people dropping out, is just because that fun element goes, and then they think, yeah, why am I doing this?
Over several months and years now, we have heard the same thing in countless conversations with managers and agents. They don't like having to dangle their rod in certain, still immature talent pools, but to opt out is to potentially jeopardise your organisation's future success or even survival. UAE boss Mauro Genetti has already admitted to us during this tour that his was a mid-table, mid-budget team, and it probably would have remained thus had Tadej Pogacar not arrived. Similarly, Decathlon's deputy CEO, Mathieu Charpentier, admitted to me in week one that Paul Sexas featured prominently in his team's initial pitch to co-sponsor CMA CGM before Sexas had even turned pro.
On parlait déjà de Paul Sexas.
UnoX Mobility and their chief Tor Husov don't have to cast their net quite so wide, given that they only sign Norwegian and Danish riders. Even so, Husov confirmed to me earlier in the tour that they too have to approach riders earlier and earlier, even if, in this particular area, he doesn't necessarily like the sports direction of travel.
I think I'm one of them. It's part of the game. It's part of It's not always, but often you see that the wrestles and talents, we can find them quite young. But it's not always the case. But if we are not following and look into younger generations, you are a few steps behind the others. So it's part of it. And also, it's for them, it's needed, because they start to ride a bike maybe at some point because they like it. But then they have a goal and a dream or something to work against. So if they see that we are there close, it also gives hope. If not, maybe the riders would stop earlier.
Yeah.
So I also see it. I see it that way.
Do you have talent scouts employed, or is it more informal? You know, there are various guys who go around. They sort of have friends, team managers who are friends, and they give them the odd tip. Or do you have actual talent scouts?
Yeah, we have people working on this, but we don't have a specific role that this or this person is a scout, and that's the job. But we have, the sports director, coaches. We have coaches in Norway who work for the schools and the sports school or cycling schools, and then they kind of, yeah. Then we have an eye in there, and then we go to races and see. You know, Scandinavia, it's more smaller soccer more that we have to follow what happened in Mexico or, you know, like in Colombia. So it makes it easier, but even though it's complicated, because, I mean, we look at the budgets now, it's crazy. When should we stop? I mean, we cannot have hundreds of riders, you know. It's so... I hope also that UCI come in and said, put quite clear rules of how we should sort this out.
Yeah, I'm sure you know that there are teams here that are giving, I think, 15-year-olds, maybe even younger, bikes. They're maybe even paying them, I've heard figures, 20,000 euros a year. Do you have any kind of system in that in place where you'll give a young, you'll support them financially?
No, but we if there's young riders like from 16 and up, we kind of can invite them to training camps. We also can support with equipment because to have that link. But I think an important thing is that we invite younger talents or young riders come into the Unix family and see how we work, because then they see that we are it's a healthy organization. We take care of the people. That's the most important thing for us. And then they know how we work, and if they try other teams, maybe that's a nice experience, and they see that, okay, at Unix, there's a good atmosphere, and we take care of the human beings, and then they would like to come back.
Do you see a fear around the paddock, around World Tour teams, of missing out on the next success? Is it a kind of scramble because everyone's just terrified that their future, the future of their team, could hinge on that?
Yeah, of course, everybody would like to find the next one, but if you look at our riders now, they were, you know, when if you look at Toss and Tran, who were yellow jersey, Jonas Abrahamsen winning stage last year in Tour de France, they were riders who came to us, and they were maybe not even top 50 in Norway because there was other five or six development teams. So we can also develop riders. But when you see with Sexas now, you read numbers, but there should be the rules, regulations of where do we stop? If the Norwegian Oil Fund will come in and support this team, we can invest billions, you know, and buy everyone. Like, you know, it has to come rules, regulations. Everybody wants that.
Just as with the wage inflation that's also a feature of the post-COVID pro cycling economy, agents make an easy scapegoat. But for the most part, they say the blame lies elsewhere, either with unscrupulous counterparts who'll stop at nothing for first mover advantage, or back with the teams. The subject is vast and merits its own series, but it would also be remiss of us not to include at least one agent's perspective here, and a defence of his profession. Andrew McQuaid is one of the more established and respected rider representatives in the field, with a client list including Tom Pidcock and Ben Healy, to name but two. McQuaid is also something of a rarity among pro cycling agents, in that he is also a qualified lawyer. We also spoke in Chambéry on Wednesday morning.
I would say it's led by teams, and then the agents are followed.
Okay. What's your agency's policy on this?
Good question. I have to think about that. We don't have a policy per se. It's my opinion on it as a whole is, like, a good agent can sign a rider young, and if they do a good job, then it's very beneficial to the rider. But obviously there are some bad agents, or agents who aren't quite as experienced maybe, who can sign a young rider and can literally send him on a bad path, him or her on a bad path, which can affect their career.
What's the youngest rider that you've got on your books?
Age. Definitely junior. I think just under 18. I don't think of any 16-year-olds. I know there are riders who are under 16 who have agents, but I don't have any now. So juniors.
Among you guys, agents, I don't want to group you all together. but whenever I talk to anyone, they say, "Oh, we don't like it, but we have to do it."
Yeah, we have to do it.
Why not? Is there not some way that you guys could get together and have like a gentleman's agreement about it?
No, there's too many different agents from different parts of the world that you'll never get full buy-in from all the agents. So that will never happen. And it's like, a lot of agents don't like it, but it's true. If I don't sign a rider by the time they're coming out of junior, they've already signed with different agencies, so you're too late. So you do have to do it. And then, like, as I said, okay, the UCI, I think, are looking at it, etc., but the way teams are going after younger riders, it is a bit of a race to the bottom, but if you sign a 16-year-old and can help him make the right decisions, then it can actually be very beneficial to an agent, to a rider. So I'm not completely against it if you can do a good job.
And just lastly then, not mentioning specific riders, but generally speaking, how do these agreements work, not just in your agency but probably no other agencies as well? Often is it equipment and money, and you don't take any commission at that time, but there's an understanding that rider will stay with you if they do get a deal?
So we, like our agency, we don't invoice a rider until they reach a certain income level, which usually is when they get to World Tour. So like I've signed, even years ago, I remember I signed a Wayne Duell when he was quite young, and I didn't invoice him for like 5 years, because he was doing track and he was on Team Wiggins, etc. So that's the way. And I think a lot of agents are the same. You sign them, but if they're not earning money, you don't charge, and then you have to work with them. And you don't know if you sign a 16-year-old, it might be 4 or 5 years before they earn any money. But it's all about long-term building the relationship with them. And that's also like why it can be good to sign a rider young. You build a relationship with them. So by the time it comes to the rider having to make important decisions, they trust you and like kind of believe or like will be guided by you to make the right decision. Yeah. So it can be a good thing.
Okay. And is there a contractual understanding with the rider that they will stay with you? Like, do you sign up? Do they have to stay with you if they go to the World Tour?
Well, no. Like, every agent contract has a time limit. Like, whether it's, I think under UCI rules with agents, it can only be for 2 years. Okay. I'm exempt from that because I'm a lawyer, so I signed for 3 years. Okay. But it's the risk you take. They can leave after 3 years. Now, if you've negotiated a contract during those 3 years, then they have to pay you off it. Okay. They have to pay you what they owe, but they can leave you. There's no lifetime contracts through an agency or anything like that.
And, okay, very last question then. World Tour teams, should they be recruiting 16-year-olds, do you think?
If they have a proper pathway where they can put the 16-year-old in and really look after them, then I don't see it as a terrible thing. But what's more, like, that pathway... if it, like, I'm maybe a little bit old school, I want 16-year-olds just to be out racing and having fun. I want juniors to be racing and like not in a environment that's like super strict, training on numbers, etc. So it can be bad for their development, I think, but yeah, there's a balance to be found.
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
One of Paul Sexas's first coaches at VC Sprint Evolution Lyon, Michael Bouffaz, quickly decided that Sexas was too exceptional for conventional wisdom to apply. For the same reason, we should perhaps also avoid drawing too many conclusions about the recruitment and development of young riders in general. Nevertheless, as the tour bent back towards the mountains this week and Alpe d'Huez loomed, familiar themes from Paul Sexas's journey towards the pinnacles of cycling re-emerged. When is time to push and time to yield? When does patience triumph over ambition? When does more speed require less haste? These were also some of the topics that presented themselves naturally when I spoke to Sexas's director sportif Luc Rowe earlier this week.
When you joined this team, obviously people might have assumed that you would go straight to Ineos, but what did you expect? What did you think you were signing up for when you came to Decathlon?
What did I think I was signing up for? I thought I was signing up to a team who had pretty big aspirations. They knew where they were going and they knew how they were getting there. And I spoke to a few teams. This is how it happened. I spoke to a few teams and said, blah, 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 blah. And I asked each the same question at the end. Where do you want to be in 5 years' time? And a lot of teams, they didn't really know the answer. And when I spoke with Dominique, I said, where do you want to be in 5 years' time? He said, oh, I'll show you. I said, how do you want to do it? He said, I'll show you. And I signed the contract. Because they're a team who knew what they wanted, knew where they were going, and knew how they wanted to do it, which to me was the first like kind of big green light. But I knew I was signing up to like a project and something that, you know, was in a good place, in a good direction, but needed a lot of tweaks and adjustments and work. And I think what I expected is pretty much what I got, and that's why. You know, there was discussions with other teams, but for me, if you start something, then don't cop out after a couple of years. Then you've got to see it through, and we're a long way from where we want to be, which is ultimately competing to come and win this race.
Was that broadly the sort of vision that was put to you when you say you asked him where they wanted to be? Was it put in those terms? That's really the bar, competing for the biggest races.
Yeah, I mean, to compete for the biggest races, not just the Tour de France. I think we got pretty big aspiration for the classics as well. So, you know, it's to be one of them big super teams and win the biggest bike races. It's quite, there was obviously a bit more to it than that, but that's it in a nutshell, yeah.
Dominique's obviously a guy who's not been around for Western Cycling for a long, long time. People don't really necessarily know him. Did what impressed you about him, and what's impressed you about his sort of vision, the way he's implemented that vision since you've been working here?
Yeah, I think it's clear he hasn't been around the sport of cycling much. He's come from a motorsport background and a rugby background, and he was highly successful in both them sports. So what he lacks in, you know, obviously he lacks some knowledge in terms of, you know, racing tactics and the way a bike race works, but what he's got that more than makes up for that is, first of all, his level of commitment. I think he's one of the hardest workers I know. Yeah, I don't know how he operates on how little sleep he has. You know, his passion, his real attention to detail. You know, if you just speak with him for 2 minutes, he'll have a laugh, and he's a bit of a character. But when you see him in the zone working, he's one of the best I've ever worked with.
Hard.
When he wants to be, yeah. When he wants to be, yeah. I think me and him, you know, we have a really good relationship, and it's a great relationship because we don't say yes to each other. And we'll, if he says something and I don't believe in it, I'll question it. And if I say something and he doesn't believe in it, he'll question it. And we're quite direct with each other. But, you know, we can really disagree about something, but only, we always remind each other, we're only doing that and we only disagree because we both want the best for the team. And if you want a yes man and someone who's going to say yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, it's not me. And that's also not the way to take the team forward. So we have we have a great relationship, and we're not afraid to like really push each other and question each other. And I think you can only push a team forward if you can create an environment where you can question each other, but in a positive manner. You can, and that's the whole team. You have to be able to create an environment where you can professionally push each other to the limit and really question every decision. So he's hard when he needs to be hard, and I think that's what a boss needs to be. So yeah.
What have you learned about 19-year-olds and what makes them tick from Paul?
Jesus Christ. I mean, he's old above his years. He's the knowledge of the kid. He's like a cycling encyclopedia. He's like pro cycling stats. He's actually incredible, his knowledge. His knowledge of the climbs, his knowledge of races, his knowledge of previous races. I mean, what makes him tick, I think, just loves cycling. Just loves the sport. Wants to win. Hungry. You know, very similar to a lot of the great champions that I've ridden with. He's just like bit of a silent assassin, you know. He's not the big character, he's quite quiet, but then when he speaks, people listen. So it's equivalent to Dan Hull there. Look, it's Dan Hull's missus. So yeah, he's like a silent assassin.
And last one, Luke, how much, obviously you come from the culture of Ineos and Sky, and they rode in a very different way. I mean, the impression is that Paul has had this sort of swashbuckling style, very aggressive style, and that's the way he's wanted to carry on riding. How much has it been a sort of friendly, daily kind of battle with him to just hold him in check? Or did he understand intuitively that he couldn't be like that at the Tour de France?
I mean, we sat down at camp and we just went through day to day and how we're going to race every stage, really.
Which camp was this? Before
the Sierra tour? Yeah, before the tour. You know, how we're going to go into it, and also before Dauphiné, we had a bit of a similar approach. And obviously, that was, I think both the Dauphiné and the tour are kind of bookended profiles. You know, the racing is very much in the last part of both races. So, you know, I'm sat there watching Basque thinking, we can't race like this, you know, and he won Basque, and that was incredible.
That was a plan, though, wasn't it? They had a specific plan to attack on that particular day, but then after that, he kind of seemed to do his own thing.
Yeah, but I think tactically, you know, you look, I think it was the last day where you have teammates pulling on the front. It's a wet descent. You're quite comfortable in the GC, and you're with teammates. And then to attack on a wet descent, I think, is not smart. You have to be patient and use the teammates to the maximum. And I just really want to make sure you don't, like, he's got a guy here who races with like panache and charisma, and you don't want to just squash that. You want him to express himself, and as you know, we're all fans of the sport. You don't want to turn him into a robot. You want to see that. You want to see that flamboyancy. But in the Tour de France, you do that, you get caught out, and
hard to find the balance.
It's hard to find the balance, and I think, you know, if you go like a bat out of hell, first 10 days in the Tour, And also you have to think of the strain on the team as well, because that also requires the full support from the team. So it's about, I mean, right here, right now, we're still outside the bus, the morning of stage 17, and we got 8 fit, healthy, and relatively not fatigued bike riders. And I would, if you went around 23 buses, how many people are in a position to say that? I would say not many. So we're in a great place. But to do that, and to arrive like this, you have to navigate the flat days, the mountains, the workload of each rider. And also another thing, just to add to that, you know, you mentioned coming from Ineos and how much did you have to like squash what he wanted to do. I think it's one thing I said when I come here is, you know, I definitely want to learn from what I've done and bring some experiences from Ineos, but at the same time I said I'm never going to copy what they do. If you copy something that they do, you're already doing something that they were doing last year. And also, let's be realistic, you're copying from a team that is underperforming. So if you say, right, at Ineos we did this, so now we have to do this, you're copying something from a team that they did that 2 years ago, and it's not. Is it one of the best 5 teams in the world now? No. So why should we bring something that they're doing in? I think anything, ideas or things that we do, it always has to be on the front foot. So almost anything that I knew, anything that I knew they were doing, the way they operate, the protocols from 2 years ago, is completely out of date. So it's about being on the front foot. It's, you know, it's yeah, trying to be a bit more innovative, that's the one. You know, and if you stand still in this sport for a second, you're going backwards. So yeah, definitely don't want to bring too much Ineos here. It's not me trying to lay on anything from Ineos. It's Decathlon, CMA, CGM, and we do our way.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freem, and Lionel Byrne.
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.